Hello, it's Thursday the 13th of January and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The number of imported COVID-19 cases has recorded another new high, leading the government to ban the use of public transport when first arriving in the country. We'll have more details in our news briefing shortly. With 55 days left until Election Day, we'll be speaking to representatives from the two main political parties today for a special Korean Politics Digest, learning more about the policies of their presidential candidates. And then coming up for Explore Korea, we'll be talking about the city of Gimhae and its links to the history of the Gaya Kingdom. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. Inbound travelers will be prohibited from using public transportation to arrive at their destination before beginning their mandated quarantine. This is part of South Korea's attempt to boost quarantine measures amid a spike in imported COVID-19 cases. Joining us now in the studio to update us with the latest on this and our other headlines of the day is our KBS World Radio news editor, Gu Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jung.
So can you tell us more about these beefed up measures and when they will take effect?
Well, according to the Central Quarantine Countermeasures Headquarters, starting from next Thursday, that's January 20th, all arrivals must use only designated quarantine buses, trains and taxis, or drive their own cars to their destination to begin their mandated isolation. A one-week flight circuit breaker will remain in place, a mechanism that suspends operations of a flight carrying three or more COVID-19 patients when entering Korea. The circuit breaker was triggered 24 times in the past 4 weeks. Additionally, the required time period for PCR test result issuance will be shortened from the current 72 hours to 48. All inbound travelers must submit a negative PCR test result before their departure. The measures come as the Korea Disease Control Prevention Agency reported 4,167 daily new infections on Thursday to raise the daily cumulative total to 679,030. Some 391 of these were from overseas, hitting a record for the second day. Nearly 68% of these imported cases were from the US, many of them Korean nationals returning from the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas from January 5th to 8th. The number of critically ill patients fell 48 from the previous day to 701.
Meanwhile, I understand the first shipment of COVID-19 pills landed on Thursday, which is hoped will help in the nation's effort to contain the virus.
Indeed. Prime Minister Kim Buk-yeom hailed the arrival, saying that Korea now has another weapon in its fight against the virus. Other than vaccines. Medical professionals will begin to prescribe antiviral pills to patients as early as Friday, which will make Korea one of the first countries to begin administering the oral medication. He expressed high hopes, saying that clinical trials showed the pills reduce the risk of hospitalizations and deaths by 88% when consumed within 5 days since symptoms begin to show. The government plans to prescribe the first batch of pills to patients with mild to moderate symptoms who have the potential to develop severe symptoms and to those with weak immune systems or seniors aged 65 or older. Authorities say they will flexibly adjust an eligibility for the pills, tracking the recipients and the supply and infection trends in the country.
Turning to the latest on North Korea now, Washington has imposed new sanctions on North Korean and Russian entities after the North's recent missile tests. They're the first specifically targeting North Korea's weapons programs imposed by the Biden administration. Can you elaborate?
Of course, the U.S. Treasury said on Wednesday they imposed sanctions on six North Koreans, one Russian and a Russian firm responsible for procuring goods for the North Korea's weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles-related programs. The steps are aimed to impede the North's advances in nuclear program and to contain the proliferation of weapons technologies. Most of the sanctioned North Koreans reportedly work for the North's Academy of National Defense Science, formerly the Second Academy of Natural Sciences, which the Treasury says is heavily involved in the North's military defense programs. Meanwhile, a South Korean foreign ministry official reiterated Seoul's calls to the North to return to the negotiating table and refrain from further exacerbating tensions. The official, who declined to be identified, said South Korea and the U.S. will maintain efforts to resume dialogue with North Korea through close cooperation to find a fundamental solution to the current nuclear impasse.
It's also understood that the U.S. is pushing the U.N. Security Council to adopt similar sanctions against these individuals.
Indeed. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas-Greenfield tweeted on Wednesday that Washington is proposing additional U.N. sanctions against North Korea after they fired the missiles in violation of UNSC resolutions. While the designation won't require a new resolution, they will have to be approved by the North Korea Sanctions Committee. It, however, remains unclear whether they will go through, as the approval requires a consensus among its member states, including China and Russia. These two North Korean allies blocked a proposal to slap additional sanctions back in September.
Let's turn now to state finances. Excess tax revenue for 2021 is forecast to further rise around 8 trillion won on top of the previously forecast 19 trillion won. Can you tell us more?
Yes, according to the Finance Ministry on Thursday, tax revenue during the first 11 months of last year rose 55.6 trillion won on year to 323.4 trillion won. Income tax, including transfer income tax and earned income tax, expanded 20.2 trillion won due in part to the booming property market and a rise in employment. Corporate taxes and value-added taxes rose in line with the recovery. There is already an excess of 9.1 trillion won from the January to November period, based on the government's tax revenue estimate of 314.3 trillion won in July 2021. Since all of the tax revenue from December is surfeit, the ministry expects an additional excess of 8 trillion won on top of its November estimate of 19 trillion won. Compared to the estimate from fall 2020, the excess is almost 60 trillion won higher. This surplus prompted South Korean President Moon Jae-in to call for ways to use the excess tax revenue to ease the financial burdens of the pandemic-hit small business owners. According to presidential spokesperson Park Kyung-mi, Moon expressed disappointment over the error, attributing it to stronger-than-expected rebound in the economy.
And finally, the minor opposition Justice Party presidential candidate Shim Sang-jung has suspended her campaign amid low ratings in polls. So what more can you tell us at this point?
Well, the spokesperson's office for her election committee issued a notice on Wednesday night saying that Shim is taking the current campaign situation seriously. The party said Shim has suspended her campaign to take time to deliberate reforms and the next step forward, adding that she was shocked by her recent low ratings. Officials added that she is not at this time considering dropping from the election or unifying with a candidate from another party. A survey by Hangil Research conducted on around 1,000 adults nationwide between last Friday and Sunday showed that 2.2% of public support Shim, the lowest rating she garnered in weeks.
We wrap it up there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
Up next, it's time for a special edition of Korean Politics Digest. Instead of talking about the week's latest issues with our regular guest, Professor Kim Byung-ju, this week we have representatives from the two main political parties joining us on the line to get a sense of what their presidential candidates, Lee Jae-myung of the ruling Democratic Party and Yoon Suk-yeol of the main opposition People Power Party, what they stand for and how they plan to win over voters with less than 2 months left until Election Day. First, we have Dr. Choi Ji-eun, who is currently serving as the spokesperson on international affairs for the Lee Jae-myung campaign. Dr. Choi, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And we also have standing by Lee Jae-young, a former National Assembly member of the People Power Party. Mr. Lee, thank you for speaking to us today as well.
Thank you for having me.
We very much appreciate both of you making the time to speak to us today, and we hope our discussion will be enlightening for our listeners out there. Let's start by looking at some polling data. The year began with news that the ruling DP's candidate, Lee Jae-myung, was leading the PPP's Yoon Suk-yeol by a significant margin, but it seemed that a lot of support for Yoon had gone to the minor People's Party candidate, An Cheol-soo. KBS's first poll of the year had Lee with 39.1% support, Yoon 26%, and An 10.6%. The poll was conducted by Hanguk Research between January 3rd and 4th on 1,001 people and had a confidence level of 95% and a margin of error of plus or minus 3.1 percentage points. Dr. Choi, let me start with you. What's been the Democratic Party's response to this and other polls recently? Your candidate has a lead, but support does not seem to be rising despite Yoon's numbers falling.
Well, this time, South Korea's ongoing presidential election campaign has been somewhat unusual, with many political controversies and negative campaigns over the candidate and their family members, including Yoon's wife, who obtained her graduate degrees with plagiarized papers and won college lecturer position with a thoroughly embellished resume. Despite all those political negative campaigns, candidate Lee has been providing his policy promises and his vision for Korea for the next 5 years. The fact that Lee's approval rating have been increasing for the past months perhaps reveals that Korean voters now fed up with the political controversies and would like to see the policy details and visions of the future leader of Korea. As Lee continues to provide his policy promises, and some of them are highly welcomed by Korean citizens, I believe that the Lee's approval ratings will continuously increase over time.
Right, okay, let me turn to you then, Mr. Lee. How is the PPP responding to these polls? Dr. Choi mentioned some scandals and controversies there. And in light of that, there was a drastic shakeup of the election committee last week. Do you think your candidate can recover? And do you have any concerns about the support going towards An Cheol-soo?
Well, I do agree with Ms. Choi about all the negative messages that both parties been using over the past several months. But at least when it comes, and none of these accusations actually for the both parties haven't come truth yet. Mm-hmm. They're, I think, all under investigations. But, you know, at least no people have died around, you know, PPP scandal, or, you know, if you look at Lee Jae-myung's biggest scandal, or what we call a Daejangdong gate. And although his investigation is still, again, under investigation, but, you know, in light of some of the known evidence or circumstance shows that there is a problem and people are asking questions. And also, and they are surprised and awestruck by the fact that two people have committed suicide who are involved in this case. Now, having said, putting that aside, when you look at the polls, if you look at Lee's approval, I think your poll that you're mentioning about KBS is already old polls, I believe. Since last week, I think the trend has changed. I think our PPP party had an internal problem, but that has been solved. And we've been seeing in different polls that Yoon's approval rate has been increasing drastically. So going forward, for the next 50 days, I think we're going to be in a good position.
Okay, so controversies on both sides, but both sides are hopeful that the next few weeks will be a further rise in their support that they'll be able to see in the polls. Let's look a bit more broadly at this election. Dr. Chair, what do you think is the key issue for voters this election? What do you think voters are looking for other than avoidance of controversies?
In my view, Korean voters are looking for a practical but also a visionary and experienced leader who can successfully manage Korea to navigate this time of great transitions and also to succeed in narrowing the social and economic gaps among citizens. This could include policies to enhance growth and also fair competition that further enables sustainable growth. Like as many other countries, today in Korea, we live in the period that economic and educational divides are becoming more prevalent in the wake of the pandemic. And we are witnessing low growth and young people in growing conflicts due to limited opportunities. And candidate Lee pledges growth through fairness as his campaign promises. And I think this kind of his campaign promises and his detailed plans to achieve his promise could be the things about the Korean voters are looking for today.
Right. So he has put forward a plan, you're saying, practical solutions towards economic growth. Mr. Lee, what would you say is the key issue for voters this time?
Transfer of power. If you look at your poll, it still shows that, you know, almost majority of our people want the transfer of power. And if you look at other polls, many polls show that more than 50% wants transfer of power. So I think that's going to be one of the key issues. Of course, I think both candidates need to show the vision for the country for the next 5 years. But I think if both candidates have been quite, you know, tied with controversies like the aforementioned controversies, but from now on, I think Yoon will also, and he has started to do so, starting a couple of days ago, about the policies moving forward, which I think are, you know, there are a couple of noticeable and pretty thoughtful and good ones.
On that note then, Mr. Lee, let's stick with you for now. Can you maybe pick a pledge that's perhaps been most important and speaks to what your candidate stands for? If you had to pick one, what would that be?
Well, if I had to pick one, I would look at his housing policy. He promised to increase supply by 2.5 million units. And it's in combination with, it's a package deal, right? So it's not only supply 2.5 million units, but we're talking about the easing the borrowing policy as well as relaxing the tax policy on both capital gains tax and property tax. And I think that's going to really help, and that's kind of message that people have been waiting for. Also, I like this policy because it's in partnership, and it's linked to Seoul Mayor's fast-track development policy. So I think Seoul has been the problem, or at least a major source of problem for housing policies. But ever since Oh Se-young became the mayor, his fast-track has been very popular. So if we get the federal level or the national level, so if you have the president and the mayor working together on housing policy in this direction, I think this is going to solve one of the problems or one of the major problems that we've been facing as a society over the past 5 years.
Okay, so Mr. Lee has chosen real estate policies as a key pledge to represent Yoon's candidacy. Dr. Chair, what is your impression of Yoon's real estate policies?
Well, I think actually Yoon's real estate policy is quite reasonable. And also increasing supply, housing supply is very important. And actually, the candidate Lee provided a very similar policy much ahead of Yoon. So both Lee and Yoon provide a similar housing policy. But if I add some more points, I think addressing both supply and demand side of housing policy issues should be implemented together to ensure that we sustain the very high housing prices in Korea today, because the supply, more supply of housing would definitely help. But the big increase, recent increase of housing price are largely driven by high liquidity and also those investors who own many houses at the same time. So I think there are some specific policy actions, as Lee promises and already announced, on the demand side of the housing policy should be also complemented to what you just discussed.
Mr. Yi, Dr. Chair, is saying that perhaps Yoon's real estate policies are similar to Yi, and the fact that Lee Jae-myung came out with some of these ideas first. What's your response to that?
Well, I think if you look at both policies, like Ms. Che said, there are similarities. But I think, going back to my comment, it has to do with who the driver is, right? This government has completely failed on their real estate policy due to incompetency. I think if you look at historically, we are more competent when it comes to housing policy. And again, the national policy has to work very closely with Seoul policy because, again, Seoul is the largest problem source. So if you have the mayor who's online and who's in line with national policy, I think it's going to work in a great partnership. So I think moving forward, looking at the real estate policy at least, it would be much better, I think, to have Yoon as a driver along with Oh as a city mayor.
Okay, so we've had Mr. Yi pick one pledge from Yoon's campaign. Let's turn to you now, Dr. Chair. What pledge do you think speaks best to what your candidate stands for?
Well, in my view, this week, Lee votes to achieve a $1 trillion in export, annual exports within his term. And I think that is my pick for the policy. Because I think that is really providing a very detailed action plan. It's a good summary of Korea's future vision to reach the economic goal of becoming a global top five countries with a GDP per capita over $50,000. And he specifically provide some more detailed plan, such as establishing five super clusters for Korea's globally competitive industries, including semiconductor, future mobility, and secondary battery businesses, and also at the same time to prevent the recurrence of supply chain crisis, such as the recent shortage of the urea imports. Lee also promises to establish a government system to oversee each ministry's responses to supply chain and economic security issues, and strengthen strategic cooperation with other allies and other countries. So in my view, such a roadmap to reach export goal could lead to Korea to be a global top five countries with a high income, which also Lee proposed as his economic target.
Right, so arguably a bit more of a broader economic policy that aims to grow the economy and a career standing in the world. Mr. Yi, what do you make of this pledge or ambition by Yi's camp?
Well, I like it. I think it's not a bad idea. And given that Ms. Che herself is a renowned economist, whatever he said in his pledge makes sense. However, again, we have to go back to the credibility of this policy. So, for example, if you look at the past history of what the Minjudang has done, I have to be very skeptical whether they will be able to deliver on that promises. And if you want to drive exports, for example, you obviously have to have private sectors on board. But if you look at their past policies, they haven't been able to do that. Private sector has been crying for past years, please leave us alone. But they've been only, they meaning this government, has been putting more regulations and more pressure on private sector. So I'm thinking one says, you know, they want to foster and, you know, push for these, the global competitiveness on key sectors. But are they right people to do so? Again, I'm very skeptical.
Dr. Chen.
Can I add?
Yes.
If I may jump in, Lee mentioned that former Representative Lee just mentioned about the credibility would be an issue for our candidate. However, I think this question should be asked for opposition party candidate Yoon, because Lee, our candidate, has been a governor of Gyeonggi province, which is the largest geographic and also area with the largest population among all the provinces in Korea. And then during his term as a governor, he kept most of his policy promises as a governor. So he actually demonstrated his credibility to achieve his economic or social targets. Meanwhile, the opposition party candidate Yoon, a former prosecutor chief, has no experience in administration or politics and has no record of achieve any economic or social target. And I sometimes doubt that if he even understands the economic issues thoroughly. So I think in terms of the credibility, Lee would be a much better candidate than Yoon. That I strongly believe.
Can I rebuff?
Yes, certainly, Mr. E.
So I think Ms. Che has made a very compelling argument. However, running Gyeonggi province and running Korea is two different things. And another thing is that when you run when you become a president, obviously your key partners on policy is, and all kinds of policies, who's there at the National Assembly. But if you look at the National Assembly members, which is very largely, you know, occupied by the Minju Party, they're going to be the same members. These are the same members who's been very, very against growth policy in period. I mean, Minjudang talking about growth policy itself is, you know, is laughable in a way. You know, not to you, Ms. Che, but, you know, again, looking at the history, that to me is a problem. Mm. So if you look at if you want to grow, if you want to talk about growing the economy, definitely I think PPP is better suited to deliver that policy.
We're fast running out of time, but I wanted to ask you both one more question. Going back to the KBS poll, some 49.5% of respondents said they still supported transfer of power, while 40.3% wanted the ruling party to remain in power. Dr. Che, as we mentioned, there's not a lot of time left, only 55 days until the elections, and almost half the population say they want a change in an administration, and that's more than the number that support your candidate. How do you plan to deal with this sentiment and turn things around in the remaining days?
Well, the truth is that in Korean politics, sadly, it is usual to see such a high supporting rate for a transfer of power towards the end of the presidential term for each administration. However, this time, we also see that President Moon is very popular compared to any other previous Korean president and with a high supporting rate. And also, many people who supported transfer of power do not necessarily think Yoon would be a right person to lead Korea. And some of them actually think Lee is a better leader to transfer of power, although Lee is coming from the current ruling party, because of Lee's very different leadership style from the current President Moon. Therefore, the supporting rate of a transfer of power has been reducing over time, and in my view, it will be further decreased as there are still many remain as a swing voters, and then they think Lee is a better candidate.
And Mr. E, what about Yoon and the PPP? What do you think they need to do over the remaining days now?
Well, if you look at the poll, I think we have to bring in the rise of An Chol-soo. So I think the transfer of power the people want is definitely not from Minjudang to another Minjudang candidate. I think it is our fault that some of our support has transferred to An Chol-soo, but if you combine that together, it still is far, far greater than the support that Lee is getting. So that shows me that even though you know, some people are still contemplating about the Yoon's policy or Yoon's candidacy. They still really want the transfer of power to opposition. So for next 55 days, we have to make sure to convince those back to our support again. So that's our remaining homework. But going back to your original question, transfer of power this time means definitely going to the opposition party, and that's what the poll is showing.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but I'd like to thank you both for today's discussion, and perhaps we could talk to you again in a few weeks' time to see how things are going on the campaign. We've been speaking to Dr. Che Ji-in from the ruling Democratic Party and Lee Jae-young from the main opposition People Power Party. We appreciate your time and your thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 10.39 points or 0.35% on Thursday, ending the day at 2,962.09. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 8.08 points or 0.82% to close at 983.25. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 3 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,187.5 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We turn now to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we find out what other news stories have been trending online in Korea today. And with those stories for us is Cheong Yeon, who's joined us now in the studio. Yeon, hello. It's good to see you.
Hello.
Okay, we're jumping straight into our stories today. So, Yeon, what do you have for us first?
Our first story is about a call for the need to reform the pension system here in South Korea amid concerns about the nation's rapidly increasing aging population, poverty among seniors, and the depletion of the national pension. According to the Korea Economic Research Institute, KERI, on Thursday, data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, and the National Statistical Office showed that the senior poverty rate in South Korea was 40.4% as of 2020, ranking first among 37 OECD countries. And this is about three times the average among the G5, consisting of the US, Japan, UK, Germany, and France. And South Korea's age 65 and above population is expected to surpass the United States by 2025 and Japan by 2045. But despite aging and poverty among seniors, South Korea's public and private pensions are poor in their ability to guarantee support.
Right, so an aging population, a huge headache for the nation, especially when it comes to the national pension, as you mentioned. What does the situation with the national pension look like currently?
So Kerry found that in the country, the proportion of national pension and basic pension is lower than the G5 average. And unlike the G5, South Korea relies on earned income for more than half of its retirement income. And the research institute argues that the starting age of pension benefits in the nation is expected to be delayed by 3 years from the current 62 to 65 in 2033. But this is still earlier than that of the G5. And the subscription period required to receive the maximum pension is 20 years, which is more than 10 years shorter than the G5 average.
Okay, and according to the Institute then, what would happen if the system isn't reformed soon?
Right, so it said that a huge tax burden would be passed on to future generations. And according to the National Assembly Budget Office, the fiscal balance is expected to turn into a deficit in 2039, and the reserves will be exhausted in 2055. And those who were born in 1990 and onwards who are eligible to receive the pension in 2055 may not even be able to receive a single penny.
Yes, this is a huge looming issue, and this data is once again a reminder that something needs to be done soon. Okay, let's move on to our second story for today. What do you have for us?
Our second story surrounds a controversial letter that was sent to a soldier for its seemingly sarcastic, borderline mocking tones. And the letter in question was sent from an anonymous student from a local all-girls high school. And an image of the letter first surfaced online on Tuesday under the title that roughly translates to "A letter received while serving in the military."
Okay, so just to explain the situation a bit more for our listeners, sometimes students in schools here in Korea are asked to write letters to soldiers to offer them support. It's essentially an activity to give back to society in this small way, to support our troops. So knowing that then, what was said in this letter that made it so controversial, Yeon?
In the letter, the author started by thanking the soldier for working hard for the country in the cold and told the soldier to do so even if it was difficult. The student also said that serving was nothing compared to the upcoming hardships in life, so the soldier must overcome it to become a true man. And she added that since she was also writing this letter, despite being a soon-to-be senior, the soldier should also work hard. And she ended by wishing good luck and telling the soldier to clean up the snow with a Korean smile emoji, which is often used ironically. Now, on the surface, this could be seen as a student wishing a soldier well in their duties and telling them to work hard. But it was really the tone that upset people, as she's essentially telling the soldier what to do, and the smile emoji and clean up the snow comment really set people off, as it was seen as a bit of a jab at the soldier.
Right, as if sweeping snow is all that a soldier does. Mm-hmm. A picture of the letter was also posted online, and it showed the letter was written in a very sloppy fashion with lines crossed out and added. It looked more like a careless draft than a finished letter. So you can imagine how a soldier serving in the military, doing his compulsory service, would feel. He wouldn't feel great about this letter when receiving it, and it's drawn quite a lot of criticism online as well, hasn't it?
Yes, it sure did, and it went beyond the letter and its author. People even identified and went after the school, leaving scathing online reviews, essentially review bombing. And meanwhile, students of the all-girls school are having their personal information circulated online, which has led some to apologizing or clarifying that it was a school assignment to send out such letters. According to them, the letters were sent anonymously because previously some soldiers looked up students' profiles and reached out to them, which the students didn't want happening again.
Well, first, going after the student or the school in this sort of witch hunt is, of course, not the right way to go about things. Mm-hmm. But second, the anonymity of the students writing these letters is understandable, as you said, are these female students are minors and that the soldiers are adult males.
Yeah, that's a very good point indeed. In fact, a national petition was set up on Wednesday on the official presidential website to ban any letters from all girls high school students being sent to military soldiers. The author of the petition criticized the school, saying that it was highly inappropriate to force underage female students to write a letter comforting adult males.
So the letter itself caused quite a bit of stir, but then it raised a further issue of whether students should be asked or forced to write such letters at all and whether it's even appropriate. So quite a few layers to this controversy, it seems then. However, let's move on to our final trending story for today. What do you have for us?
Yes, we end things off with incredible news of the South Korean Netflix original series Squid Game being nominated for 4 categories in this year's Screen Actors Guild Awards, known as the SAG Awards. And this is, in fact, the first non-English language TV show to be nominated in the awards history.
Right, this follows the Gotham Awards, of course. It won last year, and just 2 days ago, actor Oh Young-soo won Best TV Supporting Actor at this year's Golden Globe Awards as well. So the ball keeps rolling, it seems, for Squid Game. What have they been nominated for in the SAG Awards?
On Wednesday local time, SAG nominated Squid Game for Outstanding Performance by an Ensemble in a Drama Series. In addition, Lee Jung-de, who played lead protagonist Song Gi-un, was nominated for Outstanding Performance by a Male Actor in a Drama Series. And newcomer Jung Woo-yeon, who played Se-byeok, was nominated for Outstanding Performance by a Female Actor in a Drama Series. And even better, the entire team was nominated for Outstanding Performance by a Stunt Ensemble in a Television Series.
Yes, the SAG Awards also where the cast of Bong Joon-ho's Parasite won their Ensemble Award and Yoon Ya-jung won for her supporting role in Minari. But those were film awards, of course. This is the first time a Korean TV series has received such nominations. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us more about the SAG Awards and what this will mean for the Squid Game team?
Yes, the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, is a massive American labor union representing around 160,000 actors, journalists, singers, and more. And getting a nomination for the SAG Awards demonstrates the wide recognition that our Korean actors and production team have received. The 28th SAG Awards will be held stateside at the Barker Hangar Event Hall in Santa Monica on the 27th of next month.
Yes, we'll see if they do pick up some wins then. That's all for Korea Trending today. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Yewon, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you.
Next up, it's Explore Korea, our weekly segment where we journey across the peninsula, discovering more about the country's history, culture, and travel highlights. Gracing us with her presence this week is Alison Needles from the travel website Pinpoint Korea. Ali, hello. It's great to see you again.
Hi, yeah, great to see you too.
Yes, Happy New Year and all that. So what do you have for us today?
So today we will be exploring the Gaya Kingdom, which is one of the smallest kingdoms in Korean history. Mm. And it's one that's very often overlooked in favor of its powerful neighbor, Silla.
Okay, so the Gaya Kingdom, which took up, as you said, a very small area of land. And there's only really one place in Korea that really represents this area today in Korea, right?
Right. And that's Gimhae. So Gimhae might be familiar to some people. Most people probably have heard it before from Gimhae Airport, which is the only airport really that you can go if you want to go to Busan.
Right.
And so most people just drive on through. They just pass by. But actually, there's so much to see and do in Gimhae. Not only its history, which we'll talk about, but there's a bunch of great cafes like most cities in Korea. There are awesome dining options. And there's history from both prehistoric Korea and also from the Three Kingdoms period.
Okay, so it sounds like we've got a lot to cover then. The Gaya Kingdom, as we said, one of the smallest in Korean history. What more can you tell us about the kingdom's history?
Right, so Gaya, a lot of people refer to it as a kingdom, but it was really a confederacy, so kind of territorial polities. So they were small city-states, essentially. And it was on the Nakdong River Basin and, you know, the very southern part of Korea. And the dates kind of range among historians, give or take a few years, but most people place it around 42 CE to 532 CE. Mm. And so it didn't last very long, and it was later annexed by Silla, which was one of the Three Kingdoms of Korea. And the material culture that we can see today mostly consists of burial mounds and kind of things that were in there, mortuary goods. And unfortunately, the culture of the Gaya people was not really well recorded in written history. So we don't know that much about it. But we do know that they were a very big fishing and rice, you know, farming society, and that there were royal palaces in this kingdom. There were upper class households as well as lower class huts. So there was kind of a, you know, a social dynamic going on. And we also know that it was nicknamed the Iron Kingdom because of these fantastic iron items that they found, such as like some amazing battle equipment. There are these beautiful swords that exist with gold and silver inlay, as well as this incredible armor that they would have given to their horses. So I said there's not a lot, but I just said a lot. Pretty much what I said is the extent.
So a modest kingdom with a modest history, but we say modest, still 500 years, that's still quite
right.
Long. What remains today, as you said, are mostly burial mounds and iron artifacts. With that in mind, then, if one wanted to really immerse themselves in the history of Gaya, where would be the place to visit?
I think the best place and the first place you should go, the most famous one, are the tombs, the burial tombs. And they're kind of located all around, actually, Gimhae. And some of them are kind of even abandoned, not really well marked anymore. But if you go to the city center, the most famous one that you'll see is King Sudo's tomb. And King Sudo was actually one of, okay, let's not take this as fact, but supposedly he was one of six princes who were born from a golden egg in a golden basket that was wrapped in this beautiful red cloth and descended from the heavens.
Right.
And he was the firstborn. So, you know, he was the first king of Gaya. And so he was the one who led to setting it up as a kingdom. But most famously, actually, maybe even more famous than him, was his wife, who was actually from Ayutthaya, India. And apparently she arrived to Gaya by boat. And so her name is Queen Ho Hwang-ok. Mm. And she's actually still associated not only, you know, she's not remembered only in Korea, but with a place called Ayodhya in India.
Wow, okay.
So people there also, you know, they have this kind of connection to Korea. And also King Sudo, apparently he lived to be 158 years old. So who knows how much of the story is true?
That is quite the hagiography.
You're right. But anyways, his tomb is a very interesting place to go. It's been renovated many times throughout history, most recently actually in 1878 under King Gojong. And that's pretty much how you'll find it today. So there's a little bit of Joseon history in there too. Mm. And it's totally free. It's open from 9 to 6. And yeah, I definitely go take a look. It's beautiful.
Okay, so the Gyeonghae Tombs is the first stop definitely to visit and check out to relearn about this period. I understand that Gaya had a grand military history as well. What more can you tell us about this side of the story and where we can experience it?
So if you actually go to the tombs in the city center, you'll be able to look at the mountains surrounding Gyeonghae, and you can see this long fortress up on the mountain. And this is called Bunsansung Fortress. There's actually no clear date as to when it was constructed, but we can place it historically sometime during the Gaya Kingdom. And actually, in the Joseon Dynasty, it was still being used. General Bakgui reconstructed the fortress to actually defend the city against the Japanese during the Imjin Wars. So that was 1592 to 1598. It was repaired again in 1871, which is how most of it remains today. So even though it was originally built in Gaya Kingdom, again, it has this connection to Joseon history as well. But it does still maintain most of the characteristics of the Three Kingdom period architecture. There's a Buddhist hermitage that's actually, it's still being maintained. Monks are still living there. I got to meet some of them when I went recently. It was wonderful. There's people who live inside the fortress. There's tombs everywhere, because in Gyeonghae there are literally tombs everywhere. And the mountain peak, which is where supposedly, I think, where Sudo came down, where the Gaya Kingdom started on that mountain. It's a really beautiful fortress to walk along. You can see the Nakdong River as well. I think the entire fortress takes around 2 hours, and it's free. You can go anytime you want, but I think there's no lights there. It's pretty...
Right, so you've got to visit during the day.
Definitely, I recommend a sunrise walk. It's the best.
Yeah, I understand you can get some great sweeping views of when the weather is nice as well.
It's
pretty
beautiful.
Incredible that this huge fortress, there's no really construction date. There's no written history about how it was built and what it was for originally.
Must have, you know, I mean, I imagine, yeah, it's military history.
Of course.
Considering it was maintained, you know, all the way through Joseon, you would have think that they would have had some idea of its history, but nope, that's Gaia in a nutshell for you.
Interesting. But still, if you want to learn more about some of the history there, there are several museums in the city, understandably. Which would you say would be the one to check out?
There are a lot of museums, and there are a lot of museums about specific individual tombs. But for me, the best museum, not only in Gyeonghae, but honestly one of my favorite in the country, is the Gyeonghae National Museum. So this museum's been around for a while. It opened in July 1998, and it's really dedicated to the preservation of the Gaya Confederacy. It specializes in collecting and displaying artifacts that showcase not only the history, but also the little culture that they can gather. But it also displays artifacts from Byeonhan, which was a prehistoric territory in that area long before Gaya. So you can see the prehistoric culture exhibitions. You can see how Gaya kind of started to form from that prehistory. There are also some ancient stone tools you can see, and also these huge scale shell middens. So like they have all of the shells that people actually used during the Gaya Kingdom, if you find that interesting. I did. And of course, like I mentioned, Gaya is known as the Iron Kingdom. So they have this incredible collection and two galleries of these Iron Age objects, these crowns and swords and ritual implements. And of course, like most kingdoms in Korea, pottery. So there are, you know, Gaya pottery is very similar to Silla, but it's a little bit more curve and thicker. So personally, I like it better. There's just everything you want to see, it's going to be in the Gyeonghae National Museum, I promise you. It's huge, it's free to go, and it's open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., so you've got plenty of time to explore.
Well, it seems you've given us the perfect primer, really, to visit Gyeonghae and learn more about the kingdom, which you said as sometimes it's overlooked,
yes,
but it definitely sounds like somewhere to visit for the real history buffs out there.
Oh, for sure. If you're not a history buff, there are plenty of cafes, but I definitely recommend it for the history.
Sure, it still sounds like a fascinating piece of Korean history indeed. We'll wrap it up there, Ali. Thank you for sharing these great travel tips with us today, and we'll see you next time for Explore Korea.
Thank you so much. I hope you don't skip over Gyeonghae the next time you go to Busan.
This is Swiss flutist Philipp Jund. I am professor of flute at Neuchâtel Conservatory in Switzerland and at Gangnam University in Korea. You are listening to Korea 24.
We've come now to Morning Edition Preview, our closing segment where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And for that, we have joining us in the studio now our staff editor, Mark Wilson, chair, who's been looking through those papers for us. Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you too.
Okay, so tomorrow is Friday, which means the papers will print their special weekender sections. So with that in mind, what have you got for us?
Kwak Hyun-soo has a timely piece, given it's 2022, the year of the tiger, on a South Korean naturalist, conservationist, and documentarian who is dedicating his life to protecting the elusive Siberian tiger. Now, despite their names, this tiger species isn't exclusive to Russia. It's also found in parts of China and North Korea. So whenever you think of Korean traditional folktales or artwork, it's the Siberian tiger that's really featured. Sadly, a little over 600 remain in the wild, with just 20 to 30 in Korea. This abysmal figure is one of the main factors that drives Park Soo-young, who has written multiple books, withstood minus 40 degrees Celsius, and established a non-profit to protect this elusive species.
Wow, elusive indeed. I understand that unlike its Bengal counterpart, the Siberian tiger actively avoids a human contact. So very much different from their ferocious depictions in media and old stories. So I understand that Kwak also writes about how Park got into conservation in the first place, specifically about the Siberian tiger.
That's right. It was after the death of his friend in 1987, who was a university student and activist during the pro-democracy movement. That's when Park realized he didn't want a regular job with regular hours and desired to document the undiscovered world. He became a producer at a local broadcasting station where he had chances to film local flora and fauna, but it was the Siberian tiger that really aroused this compassion within him. Park developed new techniques to track the tiger, observed how they were born, how they were raised, and he could even see their fear, grief, and ultimately acceptance as they lost power over the lifespan. This knowledge has led Park to publish two books on the animal, with the English edition of one coming out in March. To learn more about his life and the work with the Siberian tiger, pick up tomorrow's Times.
Yes, and hopefully those books will help bring more attention to the plight of these tigers as well. Okay, let's move on. What else do you have for us today?
The Korea Herald's Son Ji-hyung takes us to the recently revamped and renovated Sodaemun Museum of Natural History, located in central Seoul. The museum reopened in September 2021. It's in fact the nation's first ever public museum of natural history run by a local government.
Okay, so a natural history museum. We're talking anything from, I'm guessing, dinosaur fossils to volcanoes. What would we see then if we were to walk through this revamped museum now?
Well, you'd first be greeted by a Tyrannosaurus Rex who is donning a face mask for good measure. But upon further inspection in the picture, I noticed that it was, in fact, an Allosaurus. You could tell by the shape of his skull and the number. Okay, I've been to a couple natural museums in myself.
Okay.
But so I would definitely want to check this museum out. But as you said, models, fossils and skulls galore from some of the most quintessential prehistoric beasts, Triceratops, Stegosaurus, and your favorite, Pachycephalosaurus. Again, I know my dinosaurs.
Right.
So you'll be able to see one-to-one scale models of prehistoric animals such as whales and even our early ancestors. And the museum houses some 45,000 specimens that have been collected over the past 20 years. To learn more about how you can check out this newly renovated museum, pick up tomorrow's Herald.
Definitely sounds like one for you in particular, Mark, as well. Okay, with that in mind, we're going to leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's where we wrap up our show today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then for more Korean news, views, and reviews. Until then, we hope you have a great day. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.